This podcast is for general information only. It is not intended as a substitute for general healthcare services. If you have medical conditions, you need to see your doctor. Use of this information is at the user's own risk. Welcome to FitRx with Dr. Greg Dennis. Join me as we challenge the standard sick model of healthcare. This is your source for everything health, wellness, prevention, fitness, biohacking, and more. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of FitRx. I'm your host, Dr. Greg Dennis. I know I'm a little bit behind on my podcast. It's been a few weeks since I've released one, but I'm still here and just kind of life's been hectic, but hopefully I will get back to putting out regular content as I have been for a while. Excited about today's guest, Dr. Dylan Petkus, MD. He is traditionally family practice trained, but kind of evolved to specializing in sleep medicine, specifically sleep apnea. And that's all he does now is he treats patients online for sleep apnea and gives them alternatives to, you know, CPAP machines and things like that. So just excited to kind of learn more about that. I mean, you've heard me talk on here before about the importance of sleep, but I don't know that I've ever had an actual sleep specialist or certainly somebody specializing in sleep apnea on the show. So certainly a very important topic. So Dr. Petkus, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. Well, first, I always like asking my guests just kind of how they got into what they're doing. And so especially being kind of, traditionally family practice trained and so walk us through how you went from there treating, you know, high blood pressure, diabetes, and all the stuff that family practice does into just sleep apnea.
Yeah. So the best research is me search. So long, long ago in the same galaxy, however, I had sleep apnea and like went through what you hear. A lot of people are like, if you're in a primary care clinic, like, I'm tired. I feel like I'm hungover in every single morning, even though like you're not out there drinking. And went through that of like, you know, the sleep study at that time, at home sleep studies weren't really a thing. And then, you know, gave the CPAP a good trial. By good trial, I mean like the college effort. Like I think it was like a few nights or five. Right? it didn't take long for me to be like this is not fun. And so then I really started to research a lot of, okay, how can I fix this? What are kind of the real issues there? And then kind of, I mean, fast forward like 18 months after that, much better, right? Being able to sleep through the night, not dependent on anything, not having to use mouth guards or anything like that. And that was actually before medical school and all that. I was in grad school at that time pursuing a PhD, besides to just leave with a master's because I figured writing papers can only get you so far in terms of having impact on people's lives. But that's not to say anyone who's a PhD researcher. It's still not for me. So then, yeah, went to medical school, residency, and, you know, we have worked with people online or with, you know, various conditions, and being able to help people with sleep apnea, because a lot of times it's not just sleep apnea. We might talk about that. But being able to, you know, teach them in terms of, you know, bringing down the inflammation in their body, helping them retrain their breathing, is really hallmarks of helping them restore good, healthy breathing at night, because then you have good, healthy sleep at night. And that's just what we've been doing ever since. Okay.
Let's talk about sleep apnea. A lot of people have sleep apnea. And so talk about maybe if people are out there listening and they're undiagnosed, like what are some of the symptoms of sleep apnea? What would make them think to maybe get tested? And then talk about, you know, the tests that are out there that confirm sleep apnea, and just tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah. I mean, if you're up for it, you want to do a little questionnaire, the audience can follow along.
Sure, whatever you want to do.
Yeah. Well, don't tell me whatever I want to do, though. Don't give me too much leeway. But okay, so all the folks following at home, if you're driving, keep your hands on the wheels, but you can count mentally. So it's just every one of these you have a yes for, that's 1 point. Okay, and then I'll tell you what the points mean. So snoring, do you snore loudly enough to be heard through closed doors? Okay. Number two, are you often tired, fatigued, or sleepy during the day? Okay. Number three, has anyone observed that you've stopped breathing or been gasping during sleep specifically? All right. Number four, do you have high blood pressure? Okay, the top number is more than 140, or are you taking blood pressure medication? All right. Is your BMI greater than 35? Okay. And I mean, I know it's not perfect, but the shorthand way is like, are you 40, 60 pounds overweight, depending on your height? Okay. Are you older than 50? Okay. Are you a man? Sorry, fellas. You just get one for that. And then, is your neck, is your shirt collar, greater than 17 inches? Kind of a random one, but something I'll tell people is like, if you can't reach your hands around your neck, usually that means you have a large neck circumference. Again, not perfect, but good enough. All right. So you tally all that up. If you're greater than three, you're moderate risk for sleep apnea. Greater than five, higher risk. Okay. And then just if we want to talk about kind of the algorithm and the probability thereafter, because if you get this done, like if your doctor hands you this survey, it's actually a pretty common questionnaire called the Stop Bang. Say you get handed this, you're positive. Next step is a sleep study, okay, whether in a lab or at home. And then from there, statistically, about 80% of people will get recommended a CPAP. And then that's pretty much all she wrote. So if any of that's you may want to listen to this a little bit
Okay.
more closely.
Yeah. So, traditionally, we would always think of people who have sleep apnea, that a lot of what you described, they're overweight, they have short, short neck. And a lot of times you can just, especially as a clinician, we can look at them and be like, oh, yeah, I mean, you probably got sleep apnea. It seems like I'm seeing more and more people that don't necessarily fit that criteria, that are maybe younger and maybe like yourself, that's not overweight, doesn't have a short, thick neck, but they have all the symptoms. We test them, sure enough, they have sleep apnea. What's going on there?
Yeah, because I'm glad you brought that up. Because when I tell people I had sleep apnea 12 years ago, they're like, "What were you 12?" Because I'm told I look young, so I spent a lot of time trying to look old. But then 10 years later, I'll kind of switch it back up.
For
But
sure.
yeah, so there's more, or I mean, I think it's becoming more one. Clinicians have kind of their sensors out more for it, right? And two, I would say, there's no like hard and fast study on this of where, over time we're seeing people with less risk factors have higher prevalence. There's nothing out there yet that doesn't say it's not the case, because when you notice that more, when it's like skinny guy in his 40s, or I mean, that's kind of the usual thing, like skinny 40, 50, and like having this problem. The reason why, because really how it can happen is, yes, there's these kind of classical risk factors, right? But when you look at, say, like the general population, over like how many people are overweight percentage wise, it's like 60% in the United States. I'm not sure other countries, because I don't walk around with statistics all day. But that's the States. But then like in sleep apnea, it's 70%. So like not like this huge big difference in terms of like the overweight in populations here. And there's also one BMJ, or the, I mean, that's just a journal, probably not relevant for most. But when you lose, like when patients who lose like 20, 40 pounds, they have sleep apnea, only improve symptoms by like 5 to 10%. So like a lot of these classical things aren't so much super classical, because at the end of the day, how someone gets sleep apnea is, there's going to be a greater drive of breathing at night. Okay. And then if you were to imagine the dilemma maybe you've had at Dairy Queen when you're trying to, just follow me on this. Okay. This will be relevant where we're talking about Dairy Queen. But when you're trying to drink a milkshake with like a paper straw and it kind of just folds it on itself, if you ever had the displeasure, that's what's happening inside of someone's airway. Okay. You have this greater sort of suction force, if you will, towards the back of the glottis or the back of the mouth there. It's going to kind of pull the rear of the tongue into the airway and block it. Okay. That's going to be really the main causative factor there. There's a lot of ways to get there, right? You could have a deviated septum, right? That could then, it's harder to breathe. So you have to, you have to kind of pull harder with your diaphragm. Then that'll cause that sort of pull into your airway. Or maybe, yes, weight could be a part of it as well because you're having more pressure on the airway. So it's easier to collapse it. Or even like, well, it'd be kind of a random one. You have enlarged adenoids as an adult, right? All same things, narrower airway, more airway resistance. You have to breathe harder. It's going to cause that thing to kind of collapse in, which is why that's really the mainstay of it.
Okay. Talk about why it's important to get diagnosed, or if someone has sleep apnea. So if somebody's listening and they say, okay, yeah, I have sleep apnea, but so what? Yeah, I'm a little tired. Talk about the significance of untreated sleep apnea.
Yeah, it will affect every single system of your body completely, okay? Because it's not like when we talk about like other diseases, like we don't, well, yes, it would have an impact. But like diabetes, like, okay, diabetes is bad, yes. But how much is that going to impact your sleep? Somewhat, but not a whole lot. But the moment you start to impact your sleep, so if anyone who has kids, puppies, or for some reason you just work night shift, the quality of your sleep is going to determine the quality of your life, right? Because where people will see it actually is going to be first with that quality of life, right? They're not who they used to be at work. They're grumpy as heck at home and things of that nature. And then people kind of just adjust to that because again, they're like, oh, I got sleep apnea. I just got to make sure I stay on my side or something like that. But the fact of the matter is like that's just the beginning because I think I mean, there's a lot of bad things about sleep apnea, but with, I'm going to throw all men under the bus for a moment, but I think I can do that. Is that we will tend to just put things off and off and off and off and off until it's like the pipes of birch or something like that. Sleep apnea is one of those things because every single time, like you wake up in the middle of the night, whether that is 5 times per hour, 10 times per hour, but that's going to translate to 8 times per night, right? Every single time that happens, you like choke your cells out of oxygen. Okay. It's the same molecular mechanism of like a heart attack. Okay. Cause, if you want to sound really fancy and scientific, one of the mechanisms of heart attack damage is from, ischemic reperfusion. Okay. Everyone's favorite, like daily set of words. Right. And what that means is there's this kind of like big decrease in oxygen and then there's, that will cause some damage. And then when oxygen goes back up in the heart cells, that causes damage too. Same thing happens when you like kind of like choke out in the middle of the night, but instead of just your heart cells, it's actually everywhere. Okay. Like every single cell here. So this is why when you look at sleep apnea, you will see whether it's diabetes goes up, cancer goes up, autoimmune goes up, obesity goes up, heart attack, stroke, like all the major killers are just amplified. Okay, this is why, because I know we can talk medical statistics, but I think one thing, if someone does not use a CPAP for a certain amount of hours per night, because it'll track like, patient A used this for X amount of hours per night, we like to say that is for the clinician and the patient to determine the effectiveness of this, how you're doing. That is true. The other aspect of this is that life insurance companies also will track that metric. And if that's below a certain amount, or if you're on treated sleep apnea, then many life insurance policies will drop you. Okay. Which for most people, that's pretty much someone saying, we don't think you're going to make it past 60, sort of deal. So it's very serious if not, taken head on.
I always get suspicious of it because I do a lot of hormone replacement therapy. And so when I check those levels, especially in men and especially if they're younger and their levels are really, really low, almost all the time, it seems like they have, I'm talking about testosterone here, but almost all the time they have sleep apnea. So
Oh yeah.
anyway,
Yeah, because I mean
just to your
it's gonna work. It's gonna work at two levels for that. So it's gonna be one, bad sleep quality, and then all like the hormone production, either things get sh like shunted off to cortisol, and then like now they're not left over testosterone. And the other thing is, the like the diurnal production, like that big peak of testosterone in the morning, doesn't happen for people with sleep apnea because they're just like they don't really have a circadian rhythm of anything because they just don't have any sort of sleep to generate a circadian rhythm anymore.
Gotcha. So if somebody gets diagnosed with sleep apnea, and obviously if they have symptoms, it's important to do that because of everything you just mentioned. Traditionally, that's always been one of the frustrating things for me, because there's just not a lot of treatment options. And obviously, if they're overweight, we say, you need to lose weight. That's a no-brainer. But after that, it's like, well, yeah, you can get a CPAP machine. I mean, that's about all that's out there. And so I love the fact that you have some other things, that you offer. And so talk about some of the things you do as treatment options or alternatives to a CPAP machine.
So because kind of the paradigm is I call it the reverse ABCs. It's like CPAP, then BiPAP, then APAP are the options. But what we help people with, because when we're thinking about how this all came to be with sleep apnea, because when you kind of look way back, I mean, you'll probably know what I'm talking about, but bonus points to all the listeners at home. Sir William Osler, of course, everyone's favorite person. Sleep apnea was actually first, like, it was described as like Pickwickian syndrome. Okay. And for all my Charles Dickens fans in the crowd who aren't here, essentially, that is someone being exhausted during the daytime. They have like breathing patterns that are off. Okay. And in medical school, they really only hit on how they were hypoventilating during the day. And that's why Pickwickian syndrome is now talked about as obesity hypoventilation syndrome. Okay. But the other thing about this, that's during the day, they underbreathe. At night, they overbreathe. Okay. And when they actually first were observing sleep apnea, and I think medical history is always a hoot because, like, you kind of imagine, like, at night, doctors would just sit in your bedroom watching you sleep by candlelight. Kind of funny. But they even start to think this was a form of like asthma. Like they were writing like nocturnal asthma was the thing. 'Cause they would just see people breathe so heavily. So point being, at that sort of moment in time, there was kind of two things they saw. It was the overbreathing and then people not breathing at night. Okay. So all the things like we just mentioned, CPAP or even like mouth guards, et cetera, that's going to address the like keep your airways open so you are still breathing. Okay. And that only gets so far and can be kind of annoying, right? With CPAP not always the most comfortable. So in terms of on the overbreathing side, that's where, we really help people with. Now, at that time, people are like, okay, well, why are people overbreathing? Okay, because when you go to the doctor, right, or you go to the hospital, we're doing vital signs, okay, heart rate, blood pressure, temperature, and everyone's favorite one to always mess up, respiratory rate, okay, because that's going to tell us there's something on like metabolic underneath, okay, and that's exactly in terms of what goes on with sleep apnea, okay. So looking at things like sort of metabolically, because one of the biggest drivers of overbreathing is going to be inflammation, okay. And a lot of people are already familiar with that concept just at a higher level. Like if you get the flu or the cold or something like that, you're going to be inflamed. You're going to have like congestion, hard to breathe, right? That's a kind of a more acute here. But this is like a chronic low level of inflammation now making it harder to breathe, okay? Or also that inflammation will then trigger the respiratory centers in your brain to then overbreathe here, okay? So that's why one of the first things we're doing is looking at someone's like, whether it's their nutrition, okay, looking at their environment, their stressors, their sleep patterns, all these different things to determine, okay, what are the drivers of inflammation here? Okay. And that will sort of reduce the drive to breathe here. And that'll vary person to person, because I do want to get into like a very specific breathing exercise that everyone can kind of do like tonight or later today. But that's like one layer to the inflammation. Now on the breathing side, because let's say we deal with inflammation, we're dealing with it, right? It's never just a one and done. You still need to retrain your breathing pattern, okay? Because it's just like if you got like an ankle injury, right? You need to go to physical rehab even after all the bones and the ligaments have healed to make sure you're walking properly again and don't walk with this compensation pattern forever and like mess up everything else, right? Same thing with breathing here. So long-winded way to say people are over-breathing, so you need to spend time under-breathing and then kind of get into that Goldilocks range there, okay? And we can talk about specific exercises if you like.
So just to kind of summarize that, if I may, so you try to decrease inflammation and just get people healthier, which is what I talk about on the show all the time. Nutrition, weight loss, exercise, all that kind of stuff. And just, again, getting rid of general inflammation. But then also retraining their breathing pattern. And is that correct? And that's not only at night, which is what the CPAP machines and different things do, but you're saying also during the day, because I'm assuming if you help retrain your breathing pattern during the day, you're going to help that overall circadian rhythm, which I want to talk about here in a minute. But is that kind of a correct summary?
So the respiratory centers in our brain, there, I mean, there's a lot of different features, but the most important one is known as respiratory gain or respiratory loop gain, if you want to be really specific. And that's when, like, even before we started recording this, the gain on my microphone was down. Okay. I had to turn the gain up so it could pick up the signal. Okay. Now, so when the gain is high, things are over responding all the time. Okay. So, like, your rest, like, and this is how you know if your respiratory loop gain is higher, if you're just kind of triggered into overbreathing, you go to the top of the stairs, you're out of breath, right? Okay, yes, there's gonna be a component of being a little bit out of shape, but like honestly, 13 steps, that's like more of the nervous system now triggering your respiratory drive there. Okay, so just one example. Or like if you can't hold your breath very long, right? That's gonna be a high respiratory drive. Okay, so name of the game then is to bring that down. And how you could do that, one of my favorite exercises for people to start with is rectangle breathing, okay, which is a little bit of an abridgment from box breathing, okay. So we'll just talk about rectangle breathing. So it's like a five count on the inhale, okay, right? One, two, three, or five, inhale, and then pause for 10, all right. Exhale for five, and then pause for 10 again, okay. And you just go through those cycles, okay. And this is best done if you want it the most efficient way to do this like as you're laying down before going off to bed or before putting on the mask, okay? Because then that will start to reset the respiratory loop gain in your breathing center so that you're not like always getting pushed into overbreathing by like the littlest stimuli, okay? And usually, I mean, I just like people to start to do that. Like don't even think about doing it for a time frame. Just do it as you lay down. Because it also gives a nice benefit of helping you drift off to sleep a lot more easily because it's very calming and relaxing doing it like that. So like five in, 10 hold, five out, 10 hold. And if that's too hard, you can just do like, you know, you can decrease the pause, so like 5, 8, 5, 8, or even like 5, 5, 5, 5. Okay.
You just recommend starting out at night. What about during the day? Do you have people do a similar type of exercise kind of throughout the day?
Yeah, you can also do it throughout the day. There, okay. I would recommend in the morning, and then also at another time where like you start, you feel like you're getting a little bit tense during the day because like the more your nervous system kind of gets revved up, like I talk about stress driving inflammation, stress will also directly make your respiratory centers more sensitive to overbreathing. Okay, so finding out like what those pockets or sort of things that you're most stressed out about, you know, positioning some, you know, breathing or breath work around that time will also help kind of calm things down and reduce the overbreathing.
When doing this exercise, or just in general, how important is it for people to make sure they're nasal breathing instead of breathing out of their mouth, like during the day or before they go to bed, during
Yeah,
these exercises?
incredibly important. Yeah. So nasal breathing, because ideally you can do that all nasal breathing. Okay. Always strive to inhale nasally and then exhale either purse lips. Because sometimes the actual like the sort of the pursing of the lips there that can help muscularly with some other deficits people can have, but as you do that, yeah, nasal breathing will then help augment that there. So yeah.
Okay. Are you familiar with the Wim Hof breathing?
Yeah.
How often do you, I mean, it's a little bit more involved. It's a little bit more work when I've done it in the past, but do you ever recommend that
I
type
wouldn't. I
of
would not
breathing.
recommend that for people with sleep apnea, just because. Because essentially, with that, you're blowing off a lot of CO2, so that you can shut off the sensors for breathing here. So in sleep apnea, we don't want to shut off the sensors. We want to like retrain them, readapt them to proper levels of CO2, as opposed to these like big, massive swings here. I think Wim Hof can be good. Like, I think it's more of like a performance aspect. In the absence of diseases, whereas these things are gentler and more gradual as opposed to Wim Hof, because not only we're not addressing the main issues with CO2 sensing, but also nervous system wise, it can kind of like kick you up too many notches. Where and people sleep apnea, even though they're already exhausted, their nervous system's like all the way kicked up.
Okay, gotcha. We talked about decreasing inflammation, get people healthier, then you try to retrain their breathing through some of the things you were just describing. How long does this process usually take? If you're working with someone and they say, yeah, I have sleep apnea, I'd love to get off my CPAP, and so you start working with them on these things, they start doing these breathing exercises. How long does that typically take before they can kind of reprogram their breathing to where they could maybe come off a CPAP machine?
I mean, it depends on how much they're doing. That's the first most important factor. So someone who's like doing their part, 2 to 6 months is a really good time frame
Wow.
there that
Okay.
would
So it
capture most ranges. Some
takes a
people,
while then.
yeah, it's not a quick fix, because it's not, it no one woke up one morning and was like, man, I had sleep apnea all out of nowhere. No, this is a years in the making sort of thing. Don't get me wrong, there can be people who, through trauma or like I talked to someone the other day. They're like, yeah, I had a car accident, my phrenic nerve got severed. I'm like, I can't really do something about that. Wish I could, but I can only go so far here. But that's the typical time frame, like 2 to 6 months. Usually people who are like doing more, they're more sort of action takers or taking the steps, will be closer on that 2 to 3 month time frame there.
Gotcha. So I always tell people when, they have sleep apnea that they're not getting that the REM sleep or some of that good quality sleep. As you're working with people and they're going through this, do you ever have them use some kind of wearable device like a Whoop strap or a ring to where they're tracking their sleep parameters, like the amount of deep sleep and REM sleep and stuff like that?
If they're already doing it, we'll just continue to track it. If they're not, we'll just use other subjective measures there. But in terms of like REM improvement, deep sleep improvement, yeah, those will typically be what you'll see there. I mean, it really depends, because like which one you'll see improve more initially. But over time, it sort of starts to even out, because as people are having less fragmented sleep, then we can actually go through sleep stages, get into deeper. And then also being able to maintain REM, because a subset of sleep apnea is like REM associated sleep apnea, which is when the apneic episodes are most common during REM. That's more of an issue with like mitochondrial capacity in someone's central nervous system, because if those aren't really working super well, REM sleep can't be very easily maintained there.
So I use myself as a guinea pig a lot and do a lot of sometimes crazy, stupid stuff. But I have been known in the past to duct tape my mouth at night
Or
to
duct tape.
just to train my myself to breathe through my nose. Is that something that you ever recommend or?
Yeah, so sometimes we'll recommend it as a bridge, if someone's not able to do it well themselves, because usually the oral breathing will happen as a consequence of the increased respiratory drive. Okay. Sometimes you can force it a little bit more, kind of wedge it in a good direction by using mouth tape. But ideally, that's something we use, like, if someone's like struggling to become a nasal only breather at night. I wouldn't recommend that for people who are like just starting out,
Sure, yeah.
because there's still like ways to go, because usually like we like to see certain improvements in parameters before we would recommend something like that.
Want to ask you quickly about sleep medicines because a lot of people who aren't sleeping well, whether they have sleep apnea or just insomnia, are taking a lot of sleep medicines, whether that be Ambien or trazodone or whatever. How do those affect sleep apnea, or do they?
It will vary medication to medication, and because of certain properties of muscle relaxation. And again, coming back to kind of the origin of sleep apnea here, one of the first things they tried were medications because they were like, oh, they're over breathing. Well, let's just give them things that breathe less. Right? I mean, if it was like 1920, that would make sense to me too, I'll be honest. A lot of those medications will also reduce the muscle tone of your throat. Okay. So then, yes, you're breathing a little bit less, but then your structures are that much more collapsible. So that's why a lot of these sleep medications, they'll create like a glass ceiling effect. And the thing is, people won't really even notice these deficits because they're on a CPAP. Because if you're on a CPAP and like trazodone or something else is like reducing the tone in your airways, you're not going to notice because you have like, 8 centimeters of water pressure, air pressure, going down your airways. So it's going to be kind of a moot point. But for people who are either coming off a CPAP or they're looking off optimized, yeah, many of those can reduce the muscular tone there and make someone more prone to apneic events.
Gotcha. Talk briefly, if you will, about the circadian rhythm, because your website is Optimal Circadian Health. And so I tell patients a lot of the importance of circadian rhythm and how detrimental it is for people who work, midnight shifts. And I know sometimes they can't help it, but I guess, if you will, briefly define kind of what the circadian rhythm is and why that's important in overall health.
So yeah, we picked that because I didn't want anyone to find my website. I wanted to like the like a real a word that could not be spelled correctly the first time you hear it. So anyway, but yeah, so your circadian rhythm is essentially the timing mechanism of every single process inside your body. Okay, so for people who maybe have or have seen someone with like an old school clock, like one that you actually had to wind every single day. Okay. That's inside your body too. Okay. And then that's used to like make sure, like, okay, are we making cortisol in the morning? Are we making melatonin at night? Timing the right things at the right time. Okay. Because the more that's able to happen, then your body's a lot more efficient. And that's why, like you said, like people who are shift workers, who their rhythm is like way off, like, they go outside at 2 p.m., that's their morning, right? So, like, they have this mismatch immediately of the external environment and their internal clocks. Because ideally, everyone's circadian rhythm is set by the external stimuli, okay? Because, way back, if we go to, I forget what it's called, LUCA, the common ancestor of all life. I forget the actual acronym. But if we think about like, how life and evolutionary advantages, if you were to know the timing of when things were going to happen, that puts you at a severe advantage to everything else. So being able to then have a good rhythm then allows things to like, really work like, okay, digestive enzymes go out, food comes in, we're great. Right. That's why like eating in the middle of the night like has like a negative effect on your physiology and your hormones, even though like let's say you ate 2,000 calories during the day versus like 2,000 calories, but all between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m., eating them in the middle of the night is gonna have a profoundly different physiological effect, even though it's the same amount of like, calories per se, because of how it interacts with your circadian rhythm.
Okay. So to improve that, I always tell people, try to go to bed at about the same time every night, get up about the same time every morning, try to get some sunlight, first thing in the morning if you can. What else would you add to that?
Yeah, I would say, the morning light's really, really, really important. I think the other thing is in terms of keeping your, the number one culprit is like cell phone in bed around, like that's going to ruin your circadian rhythm in all sense of everything.
Okay. Is that because of the blue light or just the stimulation you're getting or a little bit of both or?
Yes, both. So yes, the blue light's gonna pretty much tell your brain it's not like, hey, it's 9 p.m., but really it's noon time. So great. And yeah, the stimulation there because at night it's not meant to be like a like, oh, this dopamine hit. Because every time, like when you're go like a phone is pretty much optimized to elicit a human dopamine response. That's like the main thing, okay? This notification, you're scrolling, you're searching for dopamine hit, okay? That doesn't necessarily match up with how you want to be before bed, because dopamine is going to be an excitatory state of your brain, which is like not what you want when you want to be like calming things down. So both of those will interact to interfere with the release of melatonin at night.
Okay, gotcha. So do you have a rule kind of for yourself or at your house that you put your phones down at 9 o'clock or any certain time or?
I mean, I really don't like, I like, it's funny. I don't know why, but I just, this may sound funny. This is 2024. I really don't ever like use a phone for anything. I
Oh,
just
wow.
like, I'm trying to think like in medical school, if someone wanted to contact me, they would contact, someone else to then that they're like, we think so-and-so is with Dylan. Let me see. Just 'cause I just have never enjoyed using one. I hate
Wow.
texting. I hate being readily available. I hate notifications.
Well, good for you. Man, that'd be hard to get to, but I'm sure that you're better for it. So good for you for being
Yeah.
able to do that.
It was hard though adjusting to like working in a hospital because I was like, I felt like someone who was like 80s or 80 years old. I was like, how do I? Did I text you? I sent you an SMS.
That's pretty funny. Well, all right. For people to get a hold of you, if somebody's been listening, they're like, yeah, I have sleep apnea. My husband has sleep apnea. Love to get him off the CPAP machine. Your website is optimalcircadianhealth.com. Is that the best way to get a hold of you to work with you?
Yeah, that'd be the best way. That'd be a good way. You could find that website. You could also just Google search my name, Dylan Pekus, P as in Peter, Etkus, on Google, YouTube, because we have our YouTube channel and all that. Instagram, TikTok. Despite not using a phone, we're on all the social media platforms.
Perfect. Okay. And I'll also let people know on that website, the Optimal Circadian Health, there's you've got just a bunch of educational stuff on there about sleep apnea and some audio blogs, I guess. I don't know what you call them, but anyway, that's all on there for people to check out. So definitely check that out. So as we wrap up here, I always ask my guest if they could give us one health tip that would make us healthier today. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I'm gonna go with turn the cell phone off at 8 p.m. Let's just nothing ever good happens, and it's unless you're looking at my Instagram specifically, but you shouldn't. Nothing good happens. Just whether it's a book, talking to someone in your house. Oh my God, I know. Like,
Well, yeah, what is that?
I know,
Really?
right?
No, great advice. I need to do better at that. Now, I will say I at least have blue light blockers that I put on at night. But yeah, I need to just, I make my kids do it, so I need to just follow that same rule for myself. Yeah, great advice. Well, okay. Well, very good information. I like the fact that you have some alternatives to the CPAP and BiPAP machines that traditionally that's been it, for sleep apnea. So it's great to know that people have some other options there if they can, learn how to kind of retrain their breathing and that kind of thing. So Dr. Dylan Petkus, really appreciate your time and appreciate everyone listening. And we will talk to you next time.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to FitRx. I invite you to share this with friends and family. If you would like, you can check out our website at vibrantlifedc.com, or you can email me at drgreg@vibrantlifedc.com.